Welcome to today's program, a special program on WERU. I'm Max, your host. You're listening to WERU 89.9 FM Blue Hill, 99.9 FM Bangor, down east along the main coast and streaming live around the world. For the next hour, we're going to explore the drug addiction that affects more Americans and more Mainers than any other. We're going to take a look at one of the most pervasive health problems in America, a problem that affects all of us here in Maine, in our communities and homes. It impacts our economy, our criminal justice system, healthcare, and our most fundamental quality of life. We've all been touched by it, whether we know it or not. We call it alcoholism, and today, we're going to pull back the curtain, shatter a few myths, and with a little luck, offer some hope. What is alcoholism, really? Isn't it just a moral failing of weak people? Some people just drink too much. Isn't it just a matter of cutting back or stopping? It seems some people just don't want to. What is this thing we call alcoholism? And is there any real hope for recovery? We have three expert guests with us here today. Trudy Avery, Kelly McAdams, and John Dybin are here with us from the Karen Treatment Centers, here to help us better understand what alcohol addiction is and how it all works. Welcome to you all, and thanks for joining us for this special program. So let's take a moment to introduce our guests. Trudy, I guess we'll start with you. Tell us about Karen and why you work for them.
I actually have worked for Karen for the past 2 years. I am the mother, daughter, and sister of alcoholics and addicts, and I just feel so passionate about what I'm doing. Karen is based out of Pennsylvania, and in looking at the programs, I actually wanted to work for a very, very good program, and I feel extremely passionate about what I do.
Kelly, you have worked in the mental health and education fields for over 20 years. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to work at Karen.
Well, good morning, and thank you for hosting us. I have been a clinical social worker for over 20 years, and I began that journey not really knowing where it would bring me, and it's certainly been a journey that has a lot of satisfaction along the way, being able to help and to guide people. I've known about Karen Treatment Centers for a very long time as one of the leaders in the substance abuse addiction treatment field, and began working for them in the last year, and our goal is to share the message around hope and recovery.
Now we also have John Dybin here from the phone in Florida. John, I think it's safe to say you know a little something about this subject. Tell us about what you do and why.
Well, I'm the director of Older Adult Treatment Services here at Hanley Center in West Palm Beach, Florida. Hanley is one of the Karen Treatment Center's facilities, and we have several residential programs down here. But my focus is on a residential program that specifically is tailored to treating older adults who have addiction and alcoholism, specifically because it becomes different. As our bodies age, as we age, our bodies change, our minds change, the way we are able to metabolize drugs change, and we have a lot of other complications. And so down here in South Florida, we have a specific program to address alcoholism and addiction in older adults. I've been with this center for about 10 years. My background is both in ministry, I'm an ordained pastor, as well as I have a clinical background. I'm a board-certified addictions and mental health professional, and so I'm both clergy and clinician, which working in my particular program becomes very important.
So could you tell us a little bit about Karen itself? I know it's a drug rehab place. They're based in, I hear, Florida, Pennsylvania. Who is Karen? And I mean, some of us have heard of, say, the Betty Ford Center. We've heard of Hazelden. Who's Karen?
Karen Treatment Centers. John, do you want to go ahead and answer that?
No, go ahead.
Okay. Karen Treatment Centers has been around for about 60 years now, and we are certainly one of the leaders in addiction treatment. And we have centers that are located in Florida, in Texas, and in Pennsylvania. And Karen Treatment Centers works with adolescents through adults, and we provide the entire continuum of care from primary 30-day residential treatment through extended care.
Now, is this federally funded or state funded? How does it work?
No, it is not. We receive very minimal government funding. We actually, my role with Karen is I am the National Development Officer. So my role is writing grants and working with private donors to seek funds for both scholarships for treatments as well as school prevention programs.
So how expensive is it to get into a treatment program? And why do you need scholarships?
Well, as it is a medical program, similar to any medical cost. So looking at the monthly fees, it can get quite costly. Families do need to work with their insurance companies, but as we all know as family members, it usually tends to be an uphill battle when fighting the insurance companies for the treatment that is necessary and required.
So in terms of Karen, if I wanted to go to Karen for treatment, I can get some help from Karen. Is that what your job is, to help provide some of the support that allows me to go there?
That's correct. We do offer financial scholarships that is discussed during the admission process. We try not to turn anyone away. We are very willing to work with those seeking treatment along with their family members responsible for the financial requirement.
So I went in search of a definition of alcoholism. And John, you may be able to answer this question. I found that there seemed not to exist a single agreed definition. The American Medical Association refers to it simply as a chronic disease. The National Council on Alcoholism defines it as a chronic, progressive, and fatal disease.
Right.
The World Health Organization actually discourages the use of the term alcoholism, preferring to call it alcohol dependence syndrome. And I noted that in the early 19th and 20th centuries, the condition was called dipsomania.
Right.
AA, or Alcoholics Anonymous, refers to it as an allergy, and incurable at that. And I noticed that there's an AA guide, which is often referred to as the Big Book. And I'm going to read quickly here from this. And they state, it's kind of interesting, quote, "We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form, and once having formed the habit, they found they cannot break it."
Yeah.
"The classification of alcoholics seems most difficult. There is a type of man who is unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking, he changes his brand or environment, and there's the type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger. Then there are types entirely normal in every respect, except in the effect alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, friendly people. All of these, and many others, have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy, which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence." You know, it's often referred to as a dual disease, I guess, both a mental and physical components. So what are we talking about here? Is it a genetic disease, or really just a personal failing of some people who just won't stop? I mean, how hard is that? Shame on them.
So the answer to much of what you've asked, you know, and all those different things, the answer is actually yes to much of what you've said. The reality is, and great research, that a lot of those things are really coming from a similar place. So a lot of those different definitions, there are differentiations, and really the idea of alcoholism as a disease that is chronic, progressive, and fatal, that actually does come from the medical association and a lot of the literature in defining what a disease is. A disease is something that has a known set of symptomology, a known course, and that is progressive. And here's what we see when we see alcoholism is we can predict, we know the symptoms. We can predict, if it is left untreated, that it will progress. And we know what it will progress to. Eventually, it is fatal. So defining alcoholism, first of all, as chronic, progressive and fatal if left untreated is, I think, very accurate observationally. But all of these things, you know, when we're trying to define things, we're trying to define it, it's almost we're working in paradigms. And this idea of alcoholism as an allergy, though today, technically, you know, an allergy obviously has to do with the autoimmune system, and we know that, that's not really what's involved in it. Looking at alcoholism as an allergy from a paradigm is a really good practical way to begin for most people, especially for the layperson, because the reality is that question comes up. Can't they just stop? You know, I see Joe and Frank and Mary, and they can all hold their liquor, they can all drink a few drinks, and they can stop. But Mark over here, he keeps going and going and going. Isn't Mark morally just weak, or isn't he choosing this? I'll tell you that in the context of a treatment center, we see people walk in here and their lives are torn apart. Everything they love is torn apart, is in pain and misery and chaos. I have not met many people who will just by choice go to pain and misery and chaos. So there is something beyond it. And the idea of an allergy as a paradigm, it really helps for a lot of us to understand that everybody's people have, because of their genetics, and you asked about genetics, because of our genetics, some of us have different conditions and respond differently to things. And so some people can eat strawberries and be just fine. But somebody who has an allergy to strawberries, they will have a different reaction, and so they have to learn how to live life without it. It used to be theorized that there was a genetic component, that people were genetically predisposed to alcoholism, and that theory, they, you know, began to be proven when they did twin studies. And so we, and this is, you know, decades ago, they began to look at studies of twins and noted that twins that were not identical twins, so they didn't share the same, the twins that were identical twins, so they shared all the same genes, had a higher likelihood, even if they were raised in different environments, of becoming alcoholic. They were statistically more likely. And so that began a lot more research. Today we now know with alcoholism specifically that there is a genetic predisposition. Some people are genetically predisposed to alcoholism. And if they begin to, I mean, we live in a world, and specifically our nation, this is a very substance-using and substance-abusing nation. The majority of people in our, well, I mean, the numbers from the National Institutes of Health are, you know, between 80 and 90% of people age, you know, over the age of 18 in 2012 reported that they drank alcohol at some point in their lifetime. So most people in our country are being exposed to it. Some people have a genetic predisposition to react differently and to develop this disease that we call alcoholism.
So help me understand, if I come from a family, say, where I have an uncle, a great uncle who was an alcoholic, and maybe my, you know, my a cousin on the other part of the family was an alcoholic. If I have a look at my family history and can say, oh, there's some alcoholics in the family history, does that make me more likely to become an alcoholic myself or not?
It does, yes. Now, I can't tell you, obviously, I can't tell you what your genes are exactly, but if you have a family history of chemical dependency, then you are statistically more likely to develop an addiction, alcoholism specifically, if you use and abuse alcohol. So you and your buddy may go to college together, and you may drink the same amount, and then you graduate college and you get jobs, and you say it's time to grow up, and he's able to just kind of put that bottle down, and you may be, if you've developed this addiction, you're not going to be able to put the bottle down even if you want to. So the answer is that someone who has a family history of addiction is statistically more likely to develop that addiction themselves if they use and abuse alcohol.
Well, what's kind of weird about what you're saying, let's go back to the strawberry analogy, is that if I'm allergic to strawberries, I'm just going to stop eating strawberries because it's lousy. You know, you don't want to get whatever, you get a skin rash or you just feel not well. Why is it that somebody, if alcoholism is sort of, as you say, the paradigm, the analogy is allergy, why is it that even though you have the allergy, some of these people, they just can't stop drinking? I mean, if you have an allergy and it's not good for you, why would you keep doing it?
Imagine, however, it has to do with what the symptoms are of the allergic reaction. And again, allergy is a paradigm. So if there's any physicians out there, they're going to call and say, it's not an allergy. But it's true. But it kind of works the same way. So what is the symptom? If I am allergic to strawberries and I eat strawberries, well, I'm going to go into anaphylactic shock. I'm gonna swell up. There's only negative things. However, if I have this allergy to alcohol, what's going to happen is when I drink, it will affect my brain in a different way. So I don't puff up. That's not the allergic reaction. The reaction is that my brain is affected in a different way. And it's affected in a few very important ways. First of all, it affects the pleasure centers. And so there are messages sent to my brain that essentially say, this is really, really, really good and really important, and you have to go back to it. And so I develop in alcoholism, one of the symptoms is cravings. So literally a response to this, an allergic reaction, instead of being puffing up, is my brain craving more of the substance. And so as that continues, the substance will become more and more and more important, and everything else that matters in life will increasingly be diminished. It will become less important. That is actually the allergic reaction. That is the reaction of alcohol on the alcoholic brain.
Wow, that is remarkable. Thank you for that answer. It clarifies an enormous amount. I think there's an awful lot of misinformation out there. And, you know, one of the things I think that is also not fully understood is exactly what the numbers look like. And so I want to take us, the audience here, through some of these numbers and have you all comment on them. According to the World Health Organization, there are some 140 million people with alcoholism worldwide. In the United States, it is the third leading cause of preventable death. It is estimated that there are 17 million alcoholics or problem drinkers in our country. And I was amazed that for kids between 18 and 24, the statistics are alarming. I mean, there are lots of them, but here's a few. On a yearly basis, 600,000 students are assaulted by someone who has been drinking. 100,000 students are raped or sexually assaulted by someone who has been drinking. And in Maine, alcoholism dwarfs illicit drug use by more than 2-1. And according to 2003 statistics, there are more than 85,000 alcoholics in Maine and nearly 250,000 binge or problem drinkers, and we'll get into that. Now, if we're talking about any other social problem, any other social behavior here, the problem of this scope would make the headlines. There'd be community events, we'd have fundraisers, we'd have state and federal action taking place, a real concentrated effort to educate people and eradicate it. Now, how come we never hear about it? Yet our schools, our hospitals, our churches, our communities are confronted with the repercussions of this problem on a daily basis. So aside from being a pervasive social and medical problem, it's a huge tax burden, a huge drain on our economy, and it suggests it really isn't someone else's problem. So how do we address this issue? And who and where are the resources we can turn to? So I guess I'll open it to all three of you.
Well, realistically, and I, as a mother, have testified before the Massachusetts State House as well as nationally. And I recall in testimony several years ago a local police officer discussing that realistically, if we were to remove alcohol and drugs from our streets, he would no longer have a job, talking to the effect that the majority of his arrests were all alcohol and drug-related. So it does affect everyone. Karen has a very good prevention programming. I think we need to educate both the public as well as parents and as well as young children. I always say it's never too early to start.
Do you have any further thoughts on that, Kelly?
Well, I think there's certainly things that can be done at every level in our communities, as well as more broadly at the state and national level, to raise awareness and understanding around the issues around substance use and how it impacts individuals.
Okay, so so John, I'll turn this one then to you as well. Obviously, they're the larger institutional capabilities and different organizations that can help in our communities. But, you know, as an individual out there, either myself, I'm not sure if I'm a problem drinker, I'm not sure if I'm an alcoholic, I've got a wife or a husband or a friend or a child who's got a problem. I mean, practically speaking, what can I do? I'm not going to go on the internet. I'm not going to look up state organizations. I mean, this is an exhausting process. It's a giant bureaucracy. You know, it's just not my problem. Can you help me out here with something that's a little bit more simple in terms of what I can do just as a normal person in the community trying to live my life?
Several things. I mean, for one, and I just want to just comment on your question of why aren't we doing more. I think it's really important for us to be clear that there is still a stigma with chemical dependency. There is still a stigma with alcoholism. There is still stigmatization with these things. And those things that we see, you know, if we view, and a lot of our culture views, you know, alcoholism is just a moral weakness and not as a disease, or just, you know, all people feel is the pain of it. What I know is that bad things happen when people drink, and so people who drink are doing bad things. The reality is educating all of us, getting educated and understanding that this is truly a disease that needs to be treated, I think is an important point. And why isn't there more? I think there is still a stigma that this is some sort of moral failing. And as long as we think that it's a moral failing, we're not going to put effort into treating it in ways that are clinically, medically, socially, and scientifically valid. So I have to throw that out there. That's why I think it's very important that we get educated and understand the difference between a moral failing and a disease. As far as what you can do personally, you know, I want to say I am certainly an expert in chemical dependency. And a couple of years ago, I had a situation in my own life where someone in my own family began to have problems that I thought might be associated with this. The number one thing I want to tell everybody is, even though I'm an expert in this field, I did not try to handle it myself, because I couldn't. It's something that no matter who you are, if you're a physician or a psychiatrist or a doctor or a lawyer, if you're a boat captain, it doesn't matter. Sometimes we try to handle things on our own. The first thing I would say to anybody is, if you think you might have a problem, or if you're worried about someone in your family, do reach out to professionals who can help see things. Not only can they understand what's going on, but they can help from a neutral perspective where they can really see the big picture. So the first thing is, don't try to figure this out alone. The second thing is, if you're concerned that you might have a drinking problem, or that someone you love might have a drinking problem, you know, AA, the first thing would be to reach out to, and I'm sure Karen Treatment Center, Hanley, but also there are AA in just about every community. Alcoholics Anonymous is just about every community. And if you want to stop drinking, you can go to an AA meeting. You don't have to say, I understand the full, I'm an alcoholic or I'm not an alcoholic. All you have to do is say, man, I want to stop this. So the first thing I would say is, reach out to professionals and don't try to figure it out yourself. The second thing I would say is that there are resources of real people in just about every community here in the United States, and it's a place to go when you're just not sure of what else to do.
Well, to your point, which is kind of interesting, let me just say that in Maine alone, AA supports 26 different regional districts in the state with more than 800 weekly meetings, 800 weekly meetings across more than 400 towns. They're everywhere.
Yes.
I guess my question to you, and a lot of people have this question, are they some kind of private club, or are they a religious self-help group? Who is AA, and where do they really fit in?
The only requirement to go to an AA meeting, to become part of AA, is a desire to stop drinking. AA is a group of people. It has no membership. It has no dues or fees. They don't keep a roll. There is no head AA person. It's a totally unique organization. But what it is a group of people that started out very small and has become a worldwide phenomena. It's a group of people who have found that they had problems with drinking. In fact, that their drinking became unmanageable, that it caused problems in their lives, and they got together to practice a way of life that would lead to being able to live a healthy life without alcohol. And that's all, that's the entire summary of what Alcoholics is about, Alcoholics Anonymous is about.
I'm here with John Dibben and Trudy Avery and Kelly McAdams from the Caron Treatment Centers, and they're headquartered in Pennsylvania. They have huge operations around the country, one of the largest treatment centers in the world, and considered one of the premier treatment centers in the world for alcohol and drug addiction. And we'll get into a little bit more about Caron and what they do as the hour progresses. But John, to follow up on what you were saying, you know, it's interestingly, AA, perhaps, again, as you described, the most successful organization in the field of alcoholism in a funny kind of way, suggests there's more to the disease than just the mind and the body. I mean, they talk about a third spiritual element. They talk about the condition as a mental, physical, and spiritual one. What are they talking about?
You know, it's a great question, and it actually was Carl Jung who really asked, you know, began asking that question many decades ago, and he says that I realized, he was writing actually to Bill Wilson, who's one of the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, and in one of his letters, he says, I realized that the Latin word for booze, and I'm paraphrasing his letter, the Latin word for booze is spiritus. So if you go to the liquor store, it's ABC Wine and Spirits. That comes from the Latin. And the Latin word where we get the word spiritual, spirituality, inspiration, it is also this Latin word spiritus. And so it was Jung who said there's something spiritual about this when people are in this place where they need alcohol. And he said the formula for recovery is spiritus contra spiritum, which means a spiritual life defeats a life of the spirits. And this question, well, what does that mean, a spiritual life or a healthy spirituality? And what we see is this. Spirituality it simply suggests this, that every human being has a need to be connected to life, to celebrate and be connected to life. And sometimes because for many different reasons, whether it's internal or external, we disconnect from life. We become closed. We become shut down. And that need, that natural need that we have to be connected to life becomes like this hunger that grows and grows and grows. And alcohol is one way to numb that.
So in a sense, life becomes overwhelming, and so you drink.
And it becomes a way to numb that, you know, that hunger. What, in order to find true sobriety and true recovery, and what AA calls spiritual awakening, one has to realize a few things. First of all, you know, that alcohol, I have to come to a point where I recognize that alcohol has essentially become a power greater than me. It's become something bigger than me that beats me up. I've you know, worked with people from all sorts of walks of life who were able to, captains of industries, who nothing could beat me. But doggone it, this thing with alcohol, I couldn't beat it on my own. So alcohol became a power greater than me, and I found myself using it to disconnect from life. AA provides a way that says, find a power greater than yourself and find a power greater than alcohol that you can reach out to. I mean, if I'm going into a fight and with a really big bully, I better have somebody with me that's going to be bigger and able to help me. And so first of all, it helps me, A, come to a recognition that I can't do this on my own, B, get some hope that there is something, someone bigger than me that can help me. And then it goes through, and the steps help me begin with the help of a power greater than myself to begin to live a life that is truly connected, that is a healthy spiritual connection, and that is life on life's terms.
So to bring this back to a simple term, AA is really not a religious organization. You don't have to have
right.
a religious affiliation. And from what I'm hearing from you, you don't even have to have particular spiritual leanings in the sense of I'm either a Catholic or a Protestant or of the Jewish faith.
Right.
It doesn't matter at all. In fact, you could even be an atheist.
Absolutely. It is an incredible leveling ground. It is a place for anyone, regardless of whether you have a religious context or have no religious context, it's all about a way of life.
So AA talks about a 12-step program. And Karen, I know, and from the material I've read from you guys, and nearly all of the most prominent rehab or recovery care institutions around the world, talk about this thing called the 12-step approach to treatment. This is why I think people begin to think it's some kind of a religious cult or something. You know, first of all, what are you guys all talking about? What is it? And how does it work? I mean, is there any other way? I mean, and where did this 12-step thing come from? Is it like a medical procedure? Is it a, what is this for people who just don't understand? You hear it all the time. Oh, yes, you know, AA, it's a 12-step approach. And then you look at all these different rehab centers, and they have the 12-step approach. It's sort of like,
right.
What are you all talking about?
You know,
in simple terms, why don't we say that? Because I know we are limited for time. So just in a broad context, give us some sense of and why does this approach work?
It works because it addresses the very issues that are present in the disease. It actually addresses the symptoms. But here's what we mean when we say we're a 12-step approach, because there are people who never go to treatment and just go to AA or NA, and they get sober. What we recognize, though, is that there are many, many who need more help. And so when we say we take a 12-step approach, what we mean is that we foundationally believe that if a person lives a life characterized by, you know, working a program, working these steps with other people, that they are most likely, it's their best chance to stay sober. But what we recognize is that different people sometimes have barriers. It's difficult for them to. And so we not only help people get off the drugs, off the alcohol safely and treat them medically, but we also help them as they're here address potential barriers, make it easier for them to understand what this 12-step life is like, and even challenge some of the barriers, overcome some of the things that would, you know, be hard for them out in the community, and kind of get, it's sort of like getting a really good education here, beginning to practice the principles here that you're then going to take and practice for the rest of your life to keep sober.
Are these like some kind of sort of a guided law book in a sense of certain practices? I mean, it makes me very nervous when I think of, oh my God, I have to take up this whole new lifestyle and practice all these new things. I just want to live my life and stop drinking. How severe are these 12 steps?
Well, really, the 12 steps, if we break it down to the simplest terms, it's a guide for living. It's a way of life. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, individuals are given suggestions, and there's no hard and fast rules, and it's just sometimes there's this easier, softer way that when a person goes to AA, they are more than willing to share their experience, strength, and hope with another member and offer some guidelines and suggestions, and that's really what the 12 steps do.
So the World Health Organization delineates alcoholism into two distinct components, alcohol abuse and alcohol dependence. I mean, we've all seen, and many of us in our youth abused alcohol or drank too much on occasion. You know, we justified it as a rite of passage. That doesn't necessarily make us an alcoholic. What's the difference?
Right. You know, the most, in simple terms, the most important differentiating symptom is something called compulsivity. So there are a lot of people who, you're right, who would meet criteria for alcohol abuse. These are people that are binge drinking, or they're drinking too much, or they, and some people will be able, so I drink too much all the time, and then finally I'm driving home from a bar and I get a DUI. Oh my goodness, it's finally happened. You know what? I put down the bottle, I stop drinking, I don't drink again. That's alcohol abuse. Alcohol dependence, however, is I go through the same thing. I get home after 3 hours in jail, and the first thing I do is take another drink because I have this symptom of compulsivity. There, my body and my mind are in a continuous loop that no matter what happens, I constantly am thinking about the next drink. I have to have it. And some people can be alcoholic and even work 9-to-5 jobs. But these are people who, during that 9-to-5 time that they're not drinking, they're thinking about their thought is constantly obsessively thinking about 5:01 when I can get that drink. And there's lots of other subtle differences, but just for the layperson, the easiest way to understand the difference is the symptom of compulsivity. I must have that next drink.
Wow, and that's really where the allergy thing that we talked about earlier comes in.
Yes.
You know, it's sort of like there's some people who just have a sort of a genetic predisposition where that whether that pleasure place in the brain just makes you want to, you can't help yourself. Wow, and it's not a moral failing. I'm just sort of summarizing this a little bit. It really is a disease, isn't it?
Yes.
So I guess I put it out to you all here. The simplest and perhaps the most important question of our hour here together is, you know, in one's day-to-day life, in our own homes or in our own communities, how do we know if we're an alcoholic, or how do we know if someone we love or know is an alcoholic? Because we see people all the time, and how do you know? I mean, there are people out there who, think, oh, well, I'll stop tomorrow. Well, I'll stop the next day. No, I guess I'll stop on Monday. Or I got to cut back. And then we see people at parties and different social events, and they clearly, you know, they constantly have a drink in their hand, and they're drinking a lot or drinking more. They drink every day. Spouses or husbands, we see that. You know, there's a very big part of the cocktail generation, as they say, coming out of the Second World War, socially. I mean, you know, the double martini lunches. We see that on the television shows, Mad Men, things like that. I mean, it's reinforced in our culture. So it blurs lots of lines. So I guess I would ask you all, as experts in a sense, Kelly as well, and Trudy, how do you know if you're an alcoholic, or you're not sure? Gee, how do I find out? Or I'm worried about a friend. How do you find out? How do you know? Kelly, do you want to get us started?
Sure. Alcoholism is a disease of denial, and so it's very challenging for an individual to acknowledge their own disease, and so it becomes very complex. If somebody has cancer, we go to the doctor and we get a diagnosis, and there you have it, and here's your treatment. But an alcoholic mind tells an alcoholic that they're not an alcoholic. So there's that constant struggle, and so what do you do? So some of the resources that we've already talked about are seeking out a professional in the community that can maybe help guide you to come and understand what an alcoholic is. Going to Alcoholics Anonymous. There's also resources available, as we talked about. I think everything is online, and you can do some reading and research. There's also the service organization through Alcoholics Anonymous has a questionnaire, and so you can go through that questionnaire and do some self-diagnosing and answer some questions. I also think it's really important for us to talk about the family and the disease of addiction and how it impacts the entire family, and that a resource for families is Al-Anon. And there's also other self-help groups and opportunities for people, and it's not just AA or Al-Anon, although they are wonderful resources, but there's other self-help opportunities.
What is Al-Anon for those of us who really don't have a clue?
Al-Anon is actually similar to Alcoholics Anonymous. As we are aware, alcoholism is a family disease. It not only affects the alcoholic, but everyone surrounding them. You know, again, being the mother of four sons, one of whom is in long-term recovery right now, was probably one of the most difficult things that I have gone through in my life. And similar, needing the support, having the opportunity to talk to others who have walked in my shoes. So Al-Anon is that organization that allows the family members to go and get that same sort of support, because they are also feeling the repercussions of the disease.
Is Al-Anon throughout the country? Or are they?
Yes,
it is. Who are they?
Very similar, run through the same organization of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can go online, look up geographically where they are located, but they are pretty much just about in every community throughout the country as well.
It's interesting, because getting back to what you were saying earlier, John, about the stigma of alcoholism and drug abuse, and you start looking at it through the lens of being a disease. If someone has cancer or they have diabetes, there's huge support networks for these people. And I think we forget about the caregivers so often and the stress of being a caregiver. Often when you're the person with the affliction, your life gets very, very small. But for those who have to sort of manage your life with you and all the other aspects that have to be dealt with, it's extremely stressful on other family members. And you add to that in the disease issue of alcoholism, this huge stigma that you either don't want people to know or can affect your standing in the community, whatever that means, jobs, et cetera. It's a dilemma, isn't it?
It's a very real thing that people struggle with. But, you know, it one of the things, and she said that addiction is a disease of a denial, and it's true for the person who is addicted, and it can be true for the family as well. Because of those things, we don't want to admit. We don't want to say my loved one is alcoholic or my loved one is addicted either. And it's hard for families as well as for the alcoholic. And that's where Al-Anon becomes so incredibly valuable and important. It has certainly been for me in my own life, because no matter who you are, when you're chronic illness, it's interesting, when you look at alcoholism from an epidemiological standpoint, you look at it from, and you compare it to other chronic diseases, you find that the dynamics are really similar, and the relapse rates are really similar. And, you know, when I think about one of the best parallels is when I think about people who have adolescents who become diagnosed with diabetes. It's really difficult. It's an incredibly difficult thing. There's a lot of denial, especially, I mean, anyone who has a child who was diagnosed with adolescent diabetes knows that it's very difficult to accept that diagnosis. And then not only does the kid's life have to change and their behavior have to change, but the entire family has a lot of pretty dramatic changes generally that have to happen to support the health of that person with diabetes. Alcoholism is very much the same way. But it is a family disease.
But there's also, it seems to me, another component to alcoholism, which I've read about, which has to do with, let's say you're a spouse of someone in your family who is an alcoholic, and you know that. Because alcohol has certain behavioral issues associated with being, you know, in an altered state of consciousness, however you want to describe it, drunk as it were, there's certain things that it can be kind of dangerous, can't it? I mean, there's certain things that as a spouse or as a caregiver or someone who is living with an alcoholic should not do. You talked about before, reach out and get help. I think that becomes incredibly important because you're dealing with behavioral issues as opposed to, say, someone with cancer or something or diabetes. It's simply strictly a medical sort of situation inside the body. But with alcohol, it affects a person's behavior. So the people around the person who's drinking, you have to be careful. I mean, there's things you can do that it can make it worse. Can help us understand that a little bit.
Well, anytime you're dealing with, you're altering someone's state of mind. It's going to be unpredictable, and absolutely. I mean, addiction is dangerous not only as a progressive illness, but in the moment. I mean, when a person is intoxicated, drunk, high, and it all goes back to not trying to figure it out or do it on your own. And I think I think you're right that it is a safety issue as well. People who are, you know, people will say, you know, my loved one is alcoholic and I keep trying to get him or her to do things and I just can't get them to get help. What I would say is get help yourself, even if they're not. Seek out professional help, seek out Al-Anon, and get with people who can give you guidance that is objective and that can help you stay out of the danger zone.
Well, I spoke to a friend who had a drinking problem and was an alcoholic, and I said to him, how did you know? How did you know you were an alcoholic? And he said something really interesting. He said, because I couldn't remember the last time I didn't have a drink. I said, well, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, I sort of drink every day. And I was talking to someone about this. I think he was talking to his priest or someone, or perhaps his doctor. And he said, they asked me that question. Can you tell me the last day that had gone by where you did not have a drink? He said, I couldn't tell him. I couldn't remember. So I guess I come back in the most simplest forms for people in their lives. You know, if you're someone who you're not sure, you love to drink, you just love it, it's great, and, you know, you realize you drink a little bit too much and maybe I should cut back. I'll cut back Monday. No, Monday comes around. Oh, you're just going to have a drink. Just Monday. I'll cut back Tuesday. I mean, are there ways to sort of measure that issue or question? Kelly, you may have some thoughts on that as well.
Well, I think you just described something that can happen for an alcoholic, or does happen for an alcoholic, is where they lose the ability to make their own decisions around their drinking. So the alcohol is taking over and making the decisions for them about how much and how often that they're using. And I think it's also important, I want to highlight that alcoholics come in all sorts of different shapes and sizes, and the disease can look very different for different people. So some people are daily drinkers. Some people drink just on the weekends. Other people might drink with less frequency or more frequency.
Are they still alcoholic?
Yes, they can be. Yes.
And I always ask that question of myself, looking back at my own family history, two brothers, my father and my uncle. My father, a very high-functioning, successful Wall Street banker, but functioning alcoholic. Mm-hmm. His brother, my uncle, died homeless in the Bowery in New York City.
Well, it's interesting because the stereotype tends to be, oh, you know, the Hollywood version of the gutter drunk, you know, the guy you see in the street who's homeless, who's got the bottle of, you know, I don't know what, MD 2020. I mean, we tend to have these stereotypes. They're perpetuated by Hollywood. They're perpetuated by sort of pop culture. But that's really not what alcoholism is it?
No. And really looking at what happens, going back to that allergy, what happens to a person when they put alcohol in their body? And so that way, when you move away from looking at how much and how often, what is the impact that happens when that person takes that drink? What happens to them?
Is alcoholism the same for men as it is for women?
Alcohol is processed differently for women than it is for men. And women are alcoholics, men are alcoholics. And there continues to be a lot of shame and stigma for women who are alcoholics. And so I think oftentimes for women, it's very difficult for them to reach out and to get help around their drinking because women aren't supposed to be drunks.
So I know that I read somewhere, I think that quite often women who are alcoholics have a higher degree or higher likelihood that there's some other trauma in their life, specifically sexual assault or something of that nature. Does that make the road for them a little bit harder, more complicated? Do the treatment plans, say, at an institution like Karen, therefore have to be different, or do you lump everybody together? Does it really matter?
Well, I think it does matter, yes, and men can be subject to trauma as well as women. At Karen, we do gender separate and gender specific treatment, and we deal with issues that are that are specific to men and that are specific to women. And so I think treating women with women is very important, and treating men with men is important. And there is a very strong connection between a history of trauma and substance use.
So I'm a little bit confused here, John, and maybe you can help me understand this. We talked about Al-Anon, and they're a great resource, I guess, for families, and you can find them on the Internet. They're all over the country, and they're sort of organized in, very similarly and part of the same sort of structure as Alcoholics Anonymous. They're also are all over the country, all over all the states, and certainly prevalent in Maine. So why do we need a Karen? I mean, isn't Karen just redundant?
You know, like we said before, it is absolutely true that there are people who are able to, who simply go to Alcoholics Anonymous and they're able to get sober in that program. And it's kind of like there are people who are able. I mean, I'm kind of out of shape, so I want to get in shape. Well, there are lots of people that want to get in shape and get healthy, and some people will be able to simply on their own or maybe with a friend to, you know, start running, doing some push-ups and get healthy. But so if that's true, then why do we have gyms and why do we have coaches? Because the reality is that it's not an easy thing. And so not only, I mean, there's the obvious portion of some people, medical detox. If you're addicted, just stopping the substance can be dangerous. And so sometimes you need that medical process. But even beyond that, it's just like gyms. Why do we have places where we go collectively to talk to get in with professional help to learn how to exercise, to do the things that we need to get healthy when some people are able to just do them at home? Well, the reality is that most people need more of that structured support to really get over those initial barriers and then to develop that as a way of life. So for me, I would love to tell you that I'm going to start, you know, doing all the exercises that I need and making the changes in my life that I need to get where I want to be on my own or maybe just with a friend. The reality is I'm probably going to need a little more help. And that's the best analogy that I have for it.
Now, I think you're understating it, and you can all chip in here, but it seems to me that it's more than a little bit of help. It seems to me that Karen, as looking at your literature, you're talking about hiring a world-class coach, metaphor, to help you become a, you know, Olympic athlete in the sense of as you say, connecting back to life. It's impressive. I've spoken to a number of people who have gone through the Karen program, and they refer to Karen with extraordinary affection and awe and talk about how, you know, they credit Karen with having saved their life. And tell us a little bit about, you know, why they would have that perspective you know, are there advantages to going to a rehab center? I know that I think they're 28 or 30 days or something like that. What does it do for you? And why the affection?
Say that again?
I mean, why the affection? If you're there in a program called rehab, as I look at the description, I think, oh, who would want to do this? And, you know, the people come out of it, you talk to them, and they're like, wow, this is the greatest thing that happened in my life.
And you'll find that, I mean, people can't wait to come back for anniversary nights and come back and celebrate a year and 2 years and 5 years and 10 years and 20 years. We had somebody come back for an anniversary night this month who you know, was 20 years ago, was here in treatment and continues to come back, you know, to celebrate it. I think the reality is, you know, if you hear people talk about addiction, you'll sometimes hear people say, my name is John and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. And people will talk about gratitude. One of the things that a healthy way of life gives us is gratitude. And the work that it takes to develop that healthy way of life, those who help us, those places that help us along the way, often, I mean, even though it's hard, you know, why do people talk about their universities with great affection, or people talk about teachers who really helped them along the way with great affection, even though the process of school, the process of, I know soldiers who talk about boot camp with affection, and they'll say, you know, boot camp saved my life because it provided me with the, it gave me the skills, the basic raw skills that I needed to get out there and apply in the real world and to live and not die. And that's what treatment is designed to do. And with my own family member who was actually in the Karen Adolescent Program, and she was up there for 4 months. And that I mean, having an adolescent, a child in that program, she was away for Christmas, she was away for Thanksgiving, that was difficult for all of us. But today, she lives a life with skills that most kids her age can't even begin to fathom.
That's wonderful.
And so as hard as it was, there's a tremendous amount of gratitude.
Oh, that's terrific.
And as a follow-up to what John just said, I work with a lot of alumni and family members around the country, and I actually just met with a Karen alumnus who has been sober for 43 years. And one of the comments that she said to me, going through the program 43 years ago, was the fact that the staff are either in recovery themselves or are family members such as myself. And we are so passionate about what we do and are so invested in watching the recovery process of others because we have experienced it ourselves.
Thanks for joining us for this special program, and thanks to our special guests, Trudy Avery, Kelly McAdams, and John Dybin from the Karen Treatment Centers. You can find out more about Karen by going to www.karen.org. Or you can give them a call at 1-800-678-2332. Don't worry about anonymity. That's assured. But if you would like more information about alcoholism or think you might know someone who could use some help, or you're just not sure, don't hesitate to email or pick up the phone. And if you live in Eastern Maine, check out the AA Down East Intergroup at downeastintergroup.org. For more information, or you can call the AA helpline locally at 207-479-1779. That's 207-479-1779. There is always someone there for you, for a loved one or for a friend. I'm Max, and you're listening to WERU 89.9 FM Blue Hill, 99.9 FM Bangor, Down East along the main coast and streaming live around the world. Thanks for joining us for this special program. Keep the faith. No matter who you are or where you're from, there is always hope.